Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of December already. It's All Things Political, which we always kick off the week with political discussion. David Winston is our guest this hour, president of the Winston Group. It's a strategy and message design firm based in Washington, D.C. And David has served as a strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership for a number of years, including the current leadership of the House. He was formerly director of planning for Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, who is really doing very, very well in the Republican presidential field. We'll ask David about that. David also advises center-right political parties throughout Europe. He is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, or was actually, where he did statistical policy analyst and econometric modeling. Not sure what that is. Maybe we'll talk about that. He has served as a senior staff person to four RNC chairmen and has lectured at many colleges and universities. He is an election analyst for CBS News and appears on cable and network news quite frequently. We'll be welcoming phone calls for David. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send us an email, that would be just fine. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, David.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Another presidential debate. Republican Roger Simon in Politico said it's a Saturday night at yet another Republican debate, and wham, 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 Gingrich keeps blasting them out of the park.
Yeah, this is clearly his forum in terms of where political discourse occurs. He likes doing these debates. He's good at it. This is something going back to his days being on the floor of the House that he was good at, and it's a setting that obviously he does quite well in. And Saturday was another example of that.
Are you supporting him? You've worked with him in the past.
I am. I've been. He and I email back quite a lot. I mean, I'm a good friend of his. There's no official role yet. We'll see what happens there. But clearly, I'm good friends with him, and I want to see him do well.
Mm-hmm. Simultaneously, over the weekend, the president was on 60 Minutes. A CBS poll came out showing that 54% of the American public does not believes the president does not deserve to be reelected. Why is that number so high, and is this the Republican year?
Well, the reason that number is so high is obviously because of the economy. When you've had the unemployment rate so high for such an extended period of time, that's just going to take a toll on any president. When you take a look at his overall job approval, it's not very good. I think CBS had it like at 44% approved, 46% disapproved, something like that. His economic job approval is much worse, where it's in the low 30s. Having said that, his job approval could be worse given the present economic situation, but it clearly makes him puts him in a weakened position in terms of a run for a second term. Having said that, the challenge to Republicans is, he's just not going to, fold over here and go away. I mean, Republicans, what the public is looking for is, okay, if he's wrong, then what are you offering? The public is in a mood for hearing what the solutions are, not that the other person's wrong. So I think the president starts out in a difficult position. He really can't talk about his record a whole lot because it's not something at this point that it shows a lot of accomplishment. But having said that, Republicans have to come up with an answer if they expect to win.
Mm-hmm. The polls have been showing repeatedly for months now that Romney would probably do the best among the Republican candidates and would stand a good chance of winning. I know you're a friend of Gingrich's. He does have some ethical problems in his past and some personal problems, which I wonder if he'll be able to overcome.
Well, I have to say, one of the interesting moments that occurred in last Saturday's debate, and what's been interesting to sort of see how people responded, I mean, clearly the issue of the marriages came up and very difficult terms. Governor Perry minced no words in terms of saying that, if you were willing to cheat on your wife, you'd be willing to cheat on your business partner, and set up a very sort of harsh contrast. I thought Newt, and again, people should put a grain of salt on their shoulder here. I mean, I thought Newt was very sort of humble. In terms of his response, he basically said, "Look, I made mistakes," and that answer seems to have had some resonance in terms of the sort of concept of redemption, and basically put it out there. Look, people have to make their own decision in terms of whether they're going to trust him or not. That's not something that he can tell people to trust them. They're just going to have to decide whether he's really fundamentally changed or not, and that's about as far as he can go with it. And it really is up to people to sort of do that. It is a difficult element. My sense is the way he addressed it was well received. And going back to Roger Simon's article, I mean, he sort of laid that out, that he thought that was actually an appropriate response that seemed to have some resonance.
Mm-hmm. Esquire, as you probably know, has a long piece on Gingrich, including a lot of an interview with his second wife. And she says, tell me how you respond to this, what he says in public and how he lives don't have to be connected in terms of the way he conducts himself. Is that true? Can you do that? How you live?
No, I think that's why he's... No, I don't. And I think one of the things that you've seen that he's just going to have to lay out to people. I mean, has he really changed? I mean, you know, his conversion to Catholicism, trying to make the third marriage here work. People are going to have to make that judgment of whether he's really changed, and that's not something that you can assert. It's just, do people believe it or not?
He was also quoted in the article as saying that he has three things that he needs to address. And let's look at this in terms of the campaign, both Democratic and Republican. He wants to concentrate on what the country has to do to be successful. What's the answer to that, David?
Well, I mean, one of the big concerns that we've seen, and this is also the challenge to the president as well, is as people are looking at this economy, this does not seem to be, to most Americans, just a short-term problem, that there's something potentially structural that has to be addressed. And so what they're looking for are sort of answers at a scale that they think match the economic concerns that they have. And so what either candidate, what any candidate has to do, and this includes Newt, is, so what is your plan to grow the economy and create jobs? What are the economic policies that you want to lay out there? And he's gone through a variety of them in terms of creating a flatter, fairer tax. I mean, and trying to do things that will encourage small businesses to be get investment into small business so they can grow. There are a variety of things out there, and people are going to have to evaluate all the candidates in terms of looking at what their proposals are and whether they think that will effectively address the economic concerns that they have.
The president, very much in the past couple months, and in his interview last night, was talking about the growing economic inequality, that the economy right now is benefiting just a few. It's a theme, I'm sure, that will carry on into the 2012 election. What do you make of that? Is that true? The economy is working right now, but only for a few.
No, the economy is not working. I mean, because if it's, again, here's... From my sort of years of doing survey research and public opinion and talking to folks, when people look at the economy has one function in most people's eyes, and that is to produce a job for them, right? And rightfully so. That's exactly what it should be doing. And so when it's sustaining a high unemployment rate that exists like today, it is not functioning right, and things have to be done to make sure that, in fact, it does address those concerns. And this is not where people are necessarily saying, gee, that person over there is making more than me, and so therefore I'm unhappy about that. What people are just trying to figure out is how can I have the job that I need or the income I need to lead basically the life that I want for myself and my family. This isn't being jealous of other people. This is making sure that you have the ability to provide the outcomes and the resources for your family to be able to do things you want to do.
But the issue of taxes is certainly one that resonates with a lot of people. There are some who believe, as you know, and it's one of the claims of the Democratic Party right now, that the rich are not paying enough.
No, and what you're getting, and this is getting at, is a very critical difference between the two parties, and I'm sure that's not any surprise to any of your listeners at this point, and that's the debate that's clearly going on in Washington, D.C., and the difference in terms of how folks approach this, and it's just how you see it, and this is part of the debate. Democrats look, for example, in terms of, for example, extending not extending the Bush tax cuts to those making over $1 million is sort of being a way to be equitable in terms of how you raise revenues, whereas Republicans look at not doing that as ultimately raising taxes on over 140,000 small businesses. And so you have the perception of Democrats saying, look, they're millionaires, they can afford it, and Republicans saying, no, but you're raising taxes on 140,000 small businesses, that'll hurt the economy. That debate is central, I think, to what you're likely to see emerge in 2012. And you're watching two sides that have significant principles in terms of either side, in terms of how they present that, and they believe it strongly, and we'll see how that gets resolved.
Let's talk about how Congress just doesn't seem to be functioning right now. It seems as though we have a government that's unable to do much of anything. I go back to Gingrich just because he is the front runner right now. But it has been said and written that he worked very closely with a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, to salvage Social Security, that there was a spirit of bipartisanship when there needed to be in those years, even though they were highly partisan times.
Well, and again, I encourage everybody to put a little bit of salt on their shoulder on this. But this is when I was Newt's director of planning. I mean, during that time period, I mean, in terms of Social Security, reforming welfare, cutting taxes and balancing the budget, creating jobs. I mean, there was this relationship between the Speaker and Democratic President Clinton, in terms of how do we move things forward, and they found ways to do that. In this environment, that's been obviously a lot more difficult. Exactly why? I mean, I think you've got some strong beliefs here, and on both sides in terms of principled stance. And there's not this sense, at least at the moment, that people are willing to get in a room and significantly change and come to some sort of common ground. Looking at this most recent discussion dealing with extending the payroll tax cut, both sides agree to it, and what they've found is there are other elements in terms of what you would pass that along with, which is where the disagreement is. Now, ultimately, I think they'll get there, but it's created a very long and painful process that I think is probably very frustrating to not only just your listeners, but all of America as they're sort of watching this process develop.
So do you believe, David, that there is common ground on a number of issues, but the whole process is so broken and people are adhering to their positions that they won't make the common ground a reality?
Most of these members, I've obviously worked with more Republicans than Democrats, but the Democrats want to get to these conclusions. But the way the discourse has evolved at this point has created situations where it's harder to get there than I've seen it in a long time. And again, you see this particularly in terms of what can get through the Senate. And at this point, one of the things you see is in the Senate, you need 60 votes. And the problem that you've had, whether it's been a Republican leader of the Senate or a Democratic leader of the Senate, is just the difficulty in trying to, because that means you're going to need members of the other party, and the other party is trying to sort of assert party discipline, while somebody else is trying to build this majority coalition. As a result, you end up having this fight that ultimately ends up sort of splitting along party lines, as opposed to can you build the sort of majority coalitions. I mean, for Harry Reid, he's got to figure out ways to get Republicans on board, just as it was for Bill Frist to be able to get Democrats on board. That is not something that tends to be rewarded in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Well, to the detriment of the American people.
Yes. Because it slows everything. It merely doesn't slow everything down. It doesn't allow you to accomplish the things you need to do to sort of move forward.
Right.
So we'll see. I mean, I have to say again, the president basically going out and announcing that he's starting the campaign at this point, because that's kind of basically what he did. Obviously, from a Republican point of view, I think that's a little early. But from his point of view, he's saying, look, I've done everything I can, so let's just go ahead and start. But that obviously signals some difficulty in terms of a lot of issues that we have facing us over the next year. And I think the public may become even more frustrated. Mm-hmm.
We'll go to phone calls in a moment. Who is the strongest candidate to run against Obama? And do you think that Newt Gingrich can pull this off?
Well, I don't think it's clear that at this point. I think one of the things that has clearly emerged that has helped Newt is the whole debate process. I mean, clearly that's how he's come back into this race and in many states is leading. And I think there's one element that sort of looks, okay, who's got the best organization, operation, and all that, and the most money, and clearly Romney has that. But I think there are a lot of people who, on the Republican side, who are looking at the opportunity of watching Newt potentially debate Obama and think that would be a stronger candidate in terms of that particular dynamic. I don't think it's particularly clear at this point in terms of how that's going to evolve. And look, I mean, you put Newt on stage, I mean, clear in a debate situation. Again, back in June, I mean, he was written off. So we'll see.
Right. We'll see.
It'll be exciting TV.
Yeah. David Winston, our guest for All Things Political. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And we'll start taking your phone calls in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Winston, our guest this hour, president of the Winston Group, strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership, and also to European governments. We go to phone calls, and we'll start with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
What I'd like to talk about today is the Republican base and how they think and how they are exploited. And having worked in the prison system, I can say that when every inmate that goes to the parole board says that he's changed, and some actually have and some haven't, but the parole board doesn't look at it in the context of what they want to believe. They try to look at the facts as they actually are. Now, from a satirical standpoint, then, looking at the Republican base, I would say that they worshipped an ancient Indian tribe called the Wadawana Indian tribe, and their members, the Wadawanabees. And this tribe wasn't interested in looking at the truth as it actually was. They wanted to look at the truth in the context of what they wanted to believe about the truth, and they didn't want to have to question what was told to them, and they didn't want to be challenged and made to be feel insecure. And not surprisingly, of course, this Indian tribe didn't survive because they couldn't adjust to the world as it actually was. And let's leap forward now and see how this Republican leadership applies this in dealing with the base. They will, for example, accuse Obama of being an appeaser, even though his administration killed Osama bin Laden. And they do this because they know it works. And so they insult the intelligence of the base because they know that the base is gullible and believes what it's told. So they do this. They con the base. And they know that the base will take it. And the base loves people who appear to be macho because underneath it all, the base at some level knows that they're soft and gullible and need reinsurance. So they continue to con them because they know they're soft. And they have to be soft because if they weren't soft, why would they continue to allow themselves to be insulted in terms of their intelligence when the conning continues to take place and they keep coming back for more?
David.
Well, a couple of thoughts. I mean, obviously, that's a pretty harsh indictment of any political party's base. I mean, to some degree, I've heard the other argument where, in fact, the candidates have had to accommodate the political base of either party to an extreme that has, in fact, created a difficult situation in terms of whatever party eventually wins being able to sort of effectively govern because they really didn't focus on building a majority coalition. I mean, I'd have to say at this point, what the real challenge is, I would suggest to both the president and to whoever the Republican nominee is how do you effectively engage your base in such a way that allows you to bring in the political center to really build a governing majority? And Kathleen, sort of going back to the point that we were talking about before, one of the problems you see in the Senate is because there's not that clear sense of a majority a governing coalition and the focus on governing, you have these political debates that stop things. And so the challenge to either the Republican nominee and President Obama is how do you use this next election to be able to then govern after the election? And that means getting your base behind you, but it also means building a substantive support in the political center so you can effectively govern. It's a challenge for both sides.
How would you assess the way that Obama has governed the nation? What could he have done better?
I'm not sure why he said this line. This goes back to right after the 2008 election, where he had he had 60 in the Senate, so he could get whatever he wanted through the Senate, and obviously a large majority in the House, and took the attitude that, well, I won the election. If you remember, there was an initial meeting at the White House with Republican leaders right around the time of the stimulus, and the Republicans had some things they wanted to offer and interject in this process, and the president came back and said, well, I won the election, and so I want to get what I want. And ultimately, that did occur. And I think when you're the party in power, and I do this going back to the years when Newt was Speaker, it's the party in power that sort of defines the level of bipartisanship that exists, because it's how much do you let the other party into the process. And do you do it in such a way that they feel that they're being listened to and that their ideas actually get a fair hearing or not? And I think initially the president didn't really do that in a way that allowed things to move forward in a bipartisan way. Now, having said that, obviously for the election in 2010, there is a need for having that going across the aisle. But those behaviors aren't in place at this point, and it's created a very difficult situation. Now, having said that, I don't mean to just say it was just the president, because it takes, it takes two here in this situation. But I think in terms of Republicans at this point, their attitude was that the president really didn't engage and listen to them when you were dealing with the stimulus, when you're dealing with health care. And so it's created just a very difficult environment.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because as you well know, some of the Democratic base has said that this guy has been entirely too conciliatory and has not been a strong leader with strong ideas of his own.
Well, I was not a supporter. I mean, he got a very complicated health care plan through changed the direction of healthcare. I don't think necessarily in the right direction, but I mean, if you are to the left, generally a lot of the things that you wanted were in that package. The stimulus package was exactly, maybe not quite as large as Paul Krugman would like, but certainly a very Krugman-esque kind of economic solution. And so in those first 2 years, he was able to pretty much get a lot of the things he wanted, and ignored Republicans. And now that you come to where Republicans have a majority in the House and those behaviors are in place, and there hasn't been a history of cooperation.
Thanks, Jim, as always, for your Monday calls. We go to Willem in Colfax. Hi.
Hi. Just a quick comment before my main point was that when it comes to health care, I always like to point out that I don't see large masses of people in European countries or in Canada demonstrating that they are demanding private health insurance. So, there is obviously a problem with health insurance in this country, and I can't afford it, and I know a lot of people who can't afford it. So, I don't think that private health insurance is necessarily the best in the world. But anyway, my point is that I heard today that they're trying to attach this Keystone XL pipeline to any kind of movement on the budget. And I think that when you look at the, and they say we need it for our economy, but when you look at the economic impact of oil disasters like the spill in the Gulf and then the spill into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, which is still a evolving disaster, and considering that the governor and the people of Nebraska don't want this pipeline going through the Oglala Reservoir, which supplies water for a large part of the West, I think that there are other, and with the global climate change and all the implications of this dirty oil, and, I think the Republicans seem to be representing this sort of let's burn the last stick in the forest mentality rather than moving toward something more sustainable, which is, you know, through energy efficiency or all sorts of, there's a lot of old housing stock in America that could be brought up to be more energy efficient, and that could create jobs. I mean, there are other solutions than just burning more oil.
All right, let's get a response. David?
Well, I mean, clearly the gentleman's, his focus is on alternative energy in terms of wind, solar, et cetera. But the bottom line is, at this point, given the energy needs of this country, it's generally felt, and there are a lot of Democratic senators who support this, so that, in fact, it would clearly pass the Senate if it were brought to a vote. There may not be 60 votes there, but it would certainly be a majority. For that particular... For that pipeline. And the other element, too, is actually there are a lot of unions who are supporting that as well because of all the jobs it would create. So the basic concept here is, you know, it's something that will help meet our energy needs. It will help in terms of employment. Does it address the concerns of environmentalists? Probably not, and that's why the president made the decision he did. He made a choice between those two arguments, and he chose to sort of delay while he sort of worked at the environmental side of that. And I don't think anybody was particularly surprised that the Republicans tended to decide on increased energy supply, traditional energy supply, and the additional jobs, and that's not an unusual argument, I would suggest.
I read somewhere that he was moved on this issue by his base, who very smartly did the right kind of protesting.
Well, however it evolved, I mean, again, going to your earlier point, folks within the Democratic base should certainly be happy with that particular decision that he made, and it gives you a sense of they still clearly have some say.
We have heard, we did an interesting show on the electric car, Revenge of the Electric Car, last week with GM taking up the electric car and Nissan taking up the electric car and realizing that this is an idea whose time has come. And so these huge companies being at the forefront because they figure that's where their profits are going to be. What about the whole idea, though, when he brings up green energy? This has been touted as a way to create jobs in the country, David. Do you think that the Republicans and the Democrats should embrace this and encourage it and help fund it in some way?
Well, longer term, the concept of alternative energy, moving toward more electric cars, I mean, that is something over the next, you know, 25, 50, 75 years is likely to be a trend. Obviously, the challenge is, what's that transition look like? What do we do now? How do we get there? And can we force things and make them happen now when, in fact, there isn't the economies behind that? And I think when you look at something like Solyndra, that was clearly a situation where interesting concept, but ultimately it was not going to work because the economy is not set to be able to take that technology into it and do it. It's much more complex. I mean, you know, think about it this way. Let's assume everybody tomorrow could go out and get electric cars. I mean, and that's what they had. I mean, just simply, how do you charge them? And so there's not the infrastructure, the economy,
it's not in place,
and the economic infrastructure in place to sort of support that. That's going to take some time. Is that an eventual direction? I think, you know, in 75 years from now, I think there are a lot of people pointing that way. But the problem is we have to deal with the energy problems that are facing us now in the next 10 years and thinking through how would we transition. And that's the challenge. So, I think trying to force things at this point as opposed to sort of help sort of assist and let the economic dynamics of the country sort of move things forward. And I think that's where you see the difference between certainly Republicans where the president's at. And we'll see how that resolves.
Thanks, Willem, for your call. Robbie in Milwaukee. Hi, Robbie.
Hi. I was calling to say this myth about job creation by any president from now on is just a myth. These jobs are not coming back. Once we bailed the banks out and bailed these companies out so companies could really finally lay people off like they wanted to in the first place for many years, these jobs are never coming back. There's going to be no new jobs. It's going to be mostly service industry. America's going to be a may-I-help-you country. And there's only a few people that are making money, and that's true. Nobody's jealous of people who make money. It's just that the people that are making money don't create anything. They don't. They just create wealth for themselves. So this belief that we can lower taxes, which we tried before with the trickle-down economics. Bush did it for 8 years. It didn't work. We lost 2 million jobs. So this keep on lowering taxes to help. And you keep saying there's 144,000 small businesses that are a millionaire. LeBron is a small business. Any millionaire can become a small business, and then we claim them as small businesses. But there really are not too many millionaires that own small businesses, like what people really think small businesses are. So this myth that we're going to get 2-3 million jobs back in the next year, 2 or 3 years, that's not going to happen. And it's not going to happen with this type of economy and structure. I don't care if lower taxes, raise taxes. Companies are doing fine. They know how to, they're productive. They're very productive of putting people against each other, saying if you can't do it, I'll find somebody who can. And so they work longer and harder. So until those type of things changes, jobs will not come back. And I don't care what nobody says. Both parties are lying.
David.
Well, a couple things. Let me address the millionaires aspect, because when Republicans talk about the 140,000 small businesses, understand that if you are a Chapter S corporation, any of that income that comes in is treated as your personal income. So I could have a gas station, and that gas station grosses $1 million. All right. The fact is, I'm not a millionaire. I'm running a small business. But if you look at it from the point of view that, in fact, since I made $1 million, right, I'm therefore a millionaire. No, I'm a small business person. And so it's the concept of Chapter S corporations where a business's income is treated as personal income. And so that's at least that one aspect. Two, I want to go back to the idea that there's no way you can create jobs here, given the present situation. And I'm going to go back, and if you take a look in Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs, there's this interesting exchange that Steve Jobs has with the president of the United States where he basically says, you know, you're going to be a one-term president if you don't become more business-friendly. And a specific example he used the question he posed to the president is, why is it easier for me to build a plant in China than it is to build a plant in the United States because of all the regulation, unnecessary costs that you're putting on me to build that plant here in the United States? Right? And that, and in terms of what I look, and so using Steve Jobs in terms of what he was describing, I would absolutely agree in the sense of what we need to do is make it easier for American companies to build plants and hire workers here, rather than creating a situation where it becomes more attractive for them to move those workers overseas. And so what are the policies we can do to get at that?
What are they?
Well, one of the policies is lowering regulation. When the tax rate in Ireland is 15% for businesses and it's 34% here, where are businesses likely to send their plants in terms of, and where are they likely to send building their product? And so we have to figure out some way to get these plants back here and get these businesses back here so they'll do their activity here, so we can generate this sort of, you know, again, there are two visions. If you want to create additional revenue for the government, there are two ways to do it. You can either, create more taxes or create more taxpayers. And I think everybody would agree creating more taxpayers is the more desirable route.
Robbie made an interesting point in that I think it's true that the jobs that are appearing these days are service jobs and they don't pay that much money. So it's really hard to make ends meet on that kind of salary. We need something else, don't we?
Oh, no, agreed. And I think one of the things, and you've seen this actually in place for a while, and I go back to the 2006 election where you really saw this emerge. I'll explain why in a second, that the sort of cost of living hasn't kept or has outpaced the sort of increases that people have had in terms of the income they've had. And so, yes, they're earning more money, but it hasn't kept pace with cost of living. And one of the reasons for that, again, going back to the housing market, was up till about 2006, people were able to, in fact, take money out of their house and be able to supplement what they needed in terms of living, right? But when the housing, right around 2006 is when all of a sudden mortgages started to tighten up, interest rates started to go up, and people suddenly didn't have access to their house for cash anymore. And as a result, what you began to see was that beginning tension in terms of how do I manage my family finances when costs are rising faster than my income. And that's been going on now for 5-6 years, and it's a significant weight on the American family as they try to meet basic needs.
Robbie, thanks so much for your call. More phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Winston is our guest this hour, president of the Winston Group, strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership, very good friend of Newt Gingrich's, and he worked with Newt Gingrich some years ago. So that's an interesting element of the show, as Newt continues to perform well and is doing well among Republican presidential candidates. To your phone calls, more of them in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program. Did you know that Milwaukee is the third most ethnically diverse urban area in the country after New York and Chicago? We'll be speaking with people from the Urban Anthropology Organization, which is based here in Milwaukee. And it's a very interesting organization. They use students and scholars in many academic disciplines to research communities of people who live or have lived in Milwaukee and who have contributed to its culture. They do tours, they do documentaries, they're enhancing these neighborhoods. So we will talk about that, hour number two. David Winston with us this hour for All Things Political. Deborah in Grays Lake, Illinois is with us. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, David.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, even though the conventional wisdom right now seems to be that Gingrich is ahead because he's done so well in the debates, I don't think he's done that well. I think that the other front runners were stunningly lacking in knowledge of basic civics and current events. And I point to Perry and Kane, who both were, you know, ahead of him until they made some really stunning mistakes. But anyway, that's my comment. My question is about Clarissa. Since we already know that she is an adulteress because of the way that she ended up married to Newt Gingrich, and we also know she's got this vast appetite for expensive jewelry from Tiffany's, what kind of a first lady would she be able to make her even a candidate's wife in the election? And I'll get off the line.
All right. Thanks, Deborah, for the call. David.
Well, I mean, clearly the media portrayal of someone and who they really are potentially two different things. And I guess the only thing that, from my perspective of having watched Newt and Callista, they are a happily married couple. Newt converted to Catholicism, and I think that was a profound thing on his part in terms of how he views things. They are clearly, you know, deeply in love, and like he said, look, he's made a lot of mistakes in his life, and you know who hasn't. And it's up to people to decide how they're going to put that particular item in the context of overall what they're looking for in a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for a lot of people, that's going to be just sort of a personal judgment. I mean, what is facing the country, and how do they make that decision? So
let's go to Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, several comments. One question: does the base really matter? I mean, the base is going to vote the way they're going to vote. It's more, I think, up to the independents. And then referring to that lady who called about, you know, the jobs aren't coming back, I think she hit the nail right on the head. I don't think they are coming back. And lastly, it would seem to me that you also, your guest, hit the nail on the head in the sense of, you know, what Jobs said to Obama. Hey, you know, if I want to put a plant here, I have to jump through 1,000 hoops to do it. I'll just do it in China. I can't understand why the Democrats can't see that so clearly. It's crystal clear. It's so obvious. And I blame this president for creating a sense of uncertainty for the business community here. You know, it's a lack of confidence, which I think is driving a lot of this.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. David.
Now, I think he gets at one very important idea here, and this is going to be hard
going to the future, and this is what is always difficult about primaries for either party, and what's true for candidates as they move forward. I mean, ultimately, you cannot win with your base alone. Neither party can. They're just too small. I'm going to try to do this from exit poll numbers. I believe 21% of the country is conservative Republican, like 16% is liberal Democrat. Okay, you're not even close to 50% there on either side. So there's a long ways to go in terms of building that majority coalition. And part of and I absolutely agree, you have to get a significant amount of independence, because it's not just simply so much winning the election. You have to win the election. You have to ultimately succeed in such a way that you can govern after the election. And I think that's the challenge to either one of these candidates. This isn't just simply making your base happy. This is moving forward in such a way that after the election, whoever wins can, in fact, effectively govern. Again, Kathleen, going back to your point, I mean, you see the gridlock that sort of exists here.
Right.
That just can't continue. We've got to figure out some way after this election. Maybe we can get to it before. I mean, most of the American public would like to see this happen tomorrow as opposed to having to wait for an election. But ultimately, the challenge to both candidates are, and again, going to that political center, the independents, getting them in a large enough level that, in fact, you can govern. And one of the things that occurred, to just give you a contrast of how that political center can go back and forth, because the other thing that is sort of this mythology that existed is the country was just evenly divided, and, in fact, there wasn't much shifting back and forth. When you take a look at independents, you see that, in fact, they move back and forth quite a bit depending on who they think they are, what's being offered. So in 2006, well, let me go. In 1994, Republicans, when they won the majority, won independents by 14 points. When Democrats took back the majority in 2006, they won independents by 16 points. I'm sorry, 18 points. And this last election, Republicans won them by 19.
Hmm.
Okay, I believe those are the right numbers, but it's somewhere in that scale, and that gives you a sense of just how the political center really goes back and forth, and they're really looking for solutions. And so, going back to his point, that's exactly the challenge in front of both these parties.
And what percentage of Americans now, David, identify as independent?
Well, that number is bouncing around. I guess I would give you a number of somewhere around, you know, probably around 33%, about a third.
That's a lot.
About a third at this point. I mean, that's a reasonable way. But Democrats, I still think, have probably a couple of point lead in terms of party identification nationally over Republicans, with independents coming in probably around 30 to 33%.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. Well, first, this uncertainty thing, I mean, that's nonsense. A recession happens because of lack of consumption. If we had money in our pockets, we'd be spending it, and there wouldn't be this recession, but our jobs were sent away under the last administration. Now, new polls coming out from South Carolina, you know, with this big feeling that Obama, you know, is going down and he's just really a sinking ship. You know, South Carolina, President Obama up against Newt Gingrich and up against Mitt Romney, both. He beats them both by a few points. Now, this is in South Carolina. So, I just don't believe that. This gridlock thing, too. You know, Newt is known as the godfather of gridlock. I mean, look what happened in 94. He convinced everybody to not have relationships with the people on the other side, to not move to Washington. Before that, these guys, they lived in Washington. Their kids played on the same ball teams. They knew each other. They had relationships. They worked with each other. Newt made sure that stopped. He said everybody should leave. Go back and tell everyone that you got to talk to your people. Well, that destroyed the relationships. That brought on this gridlock and this lurch to the right, a huge lurch to the right.
Did he say that, David?
No. I mean, he obviously said, look, you know, as you come to Washington, you need to make sure that you listen to your constituents, right? And not a particularly surprising advice from any speaker to any member. And obviously, I'm going to disagree in terms of, you know, again, you had welfare reform, you had Social Security, you balanced the budget, you cut taxes, you had economic growth, you had job creation. All that was done in a partnership with the Democratic president. And so I would obviously disagree with that. Having said that, that doesn't mean that the situation now
because I'm saying that isn't any less frustrating, but I think one of the things that we need to be looking toward is, in fact, what was working then in a way that people were, in fact, able to cross the aisle that seems to be difficulty at this point in time.
Thanks, Dave, very much for your call. Ed in Wausau, hi.
Hi. I'm a shortwave radioactive addict, but the one thing I can remember with Newt was when he refused to fund the International Monetary Fund, and I could listen to my shortwave radio and just hear currency or world currencies fall around the world because we refused to give our a commitment to the IMF, and that was just devastating for world economies.
What do you listen to on shortwave, Ed?
Right now, I'm kind of off shortwave. At that time, you could just follow it around the world, all the currencies that were going down the tubes because of our refusal to honor the IMF commitment that we had made.
David.
I have to say, I'm not particularly familiar with that, so I'm not sure I have much to offer on that particular question. Sorry.
All right. Thanks, Ed, very much for your call. Diane in Middleton. Hi.
Good morning. During this hour, you've discussed his personal lapses, but we have not, I don't think, heard anything about the fact that he had the most violations of anybody in Congress and received the highest fines the Congress ever levied against anyone.
David.
Yeah, no, that's true. But it was not a fine. Ultimately, he was exonerated of that. And this is an important distinction. What he ultimately ended up... Here is the situation. He was supposed to file some paperwork that he improperly filed. Because of that, it generated a huge investigation. As it turns out, he was correct, but because he misfiled the paperwork, it cost the Congress a huge amount of money to be able to sort of go through this whole process. So he was asked to pay that back, and that was where the $300,000, a significant number, but that's how the $300,000 came into being.
There have been a lot of news reports about his financial dealings now, and whether or not he's a lobbyist and how much money he was paid for working for certain companies. Do you think that's all going to wash fine, or are there financial improprieties that he's going to be subjected to investigation as people start looking at him pretty carefully?
Well, and again, I'm going to ask everybody to put a grain of salt.
I know.
Okay.
You're his friend. I know.
Okay. Look, when you've been in a role, this is going to sound odd to people, but that understanding how, in fact, Congress operates is a very complicated thing to the outside world. And so when you can have someone who you say, look, I have this idea, what do you think the reaction of it will be? What's the sort of strategy to think through? Is this an idea that is has some compelling nature to it? That in his role, having led the House, that he can actually help an organization think through what the reactions to ideas might be and what that process might be. And again, in some cases, he would say, you know, what you're proposing just simply won't work, right? Or sometimes he would come back and say, well, you know, if you modified it this way, it might have some better standing. But ultimately, his goal was not to go lobby with individual members. It was as individuals had ideas and they were trying to figure out, in fact, how did you turn that into actual public policy? How should you approach that? Having said that, there are large sums of money involved, and so that obviously complicates Newt's debate as he sort of describes that.
Right. And getting back to Diane's point, if what you said is true, David, then why did Newt resign from Congress and quit his job as Speaker of the House?
Well, in that election, that's an example of where he set some, where there are some high expectations that were set in terms of how many seats were going to be picked up. The expectation had been 20 to 30, and in fact, There were a few lost. And looking at that situation after the election, and having talked to a variety of different members, he decided that it was time for somebody new to take over, and he left. Now, if it had gone to an actual vote, what would that have looked like? Don't know, but we never actually got there.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, thank you so much for being with us. It's always
a pleasure
to talk with you. Thanks, David. David Winston, our guest this hour for All Things Political. He is president of the Winston Group, strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership, including a key advisor to John Boehner right now. And he worked for a number of years with Newt Gingrich. He is a friend of his. He was involved in helping to plan policy for the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. So that's it for All Things Political. I really love doing this hour. It's great fun. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. You're informed. You know the history, and you got thoughts and opinions, and that's good. Thanks very much to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Stay with us for the next hour. For those of you who would like to know a little bit more about the largest city in the state of Wisconsin and its amazing ethnic diversity, we'll be talking about that and learning about that the second hour of our program. Stay with us.